everyone is hungry. The United Nations says Israel is destroying Gaza's food system and weaponizing food. Hello and welcome back to Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Pourreza in London. Before anything, here's a recap of some of the latest developments of the past 24 hours. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed or wounded in Israeli airstrikes on several areas in the Gaza Strip over the past 24 hours, as the occupation regime presses ahead with its genocidal war against the besieged territory. The UN says Gazans now make up 80% of all people facing famine or catastrophic hunger worldwide, marking an unprecedented humanitarian crisis in the blockaded territory. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has once again appealed for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Also at the forum, the Palestinian Authority Minister of Social Development, who has called for pressure on Israeli authorities to open all of the crossings into the Gaza Strip to allow in relief and medical supplies. Despite the impending famine and the carnage in Gaza, Germany's government is considering the delivery of tank ammunition to the Israeli regime with U.S. approval. Since the start of the aggression, the Israeli regime has killed at least 24,500 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and injured at least 61,500 more. On this program, Carol Swords, a humanitarian campaigner. Carol is a longtime pro-Palestinian advocate and even prouder great-grandmother. Via Skype from Leeds, author and imam of Bab al-Ilm, Sheikh Jafar Ladak. Thank you very much to both of you for being here. I'll start with you, Carol, and I'm going to start with a quote from the American political scientist Robert Pape, who said of the Gaza massacre in the following words: Gaza, quote, is one of the most intense civilian punishment campaigns in history. It now sits comfortably in the top quartile of the most devastating bombing campaigns ever. Speak to that.
I wouldn't say they're sitting comfortably at all, would you? How can we go back a little bit? Germany be sending tanks. They should be sending aid. They should be 80% of the world's population starving. Why aren't they sending food? Why are they sending weapons with the US approval? It's unbelievable. I can't understand why a country called Germany, who should be reeling what's going on, reeling, and the people of Germany must be like the people of the UK, having a government that's working against what the people really want, to send weaponry to kill more Palestinians. 25,000 people dead in Gaza already. How that's not, and 60,000 injured, not counting the millions displaced. Where I live, there's six little schools, maybe 300 kids in each school. That, put that into some kind of perspective, that's every kid in every class, in every school, dead, gone. Well, families, that's it. Not including their parents, their cousins, their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents, their dogs, their cats. Gone. Forever. Never to come back. And they're still wanting to send weapons to kill more. It beggars belief that even the most stupid person in the world wouldn't even believe something like that could be happening.
And the Germans bought a missile system from the Israeli regime just last year to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sheikh Ladak, some of the most influential voices in the global stage are together at Davos, Switzerland, as we speak. Other than the lack of political will to stop the bloodbath in Gaza, what else do you think is preventing those leaders to act on what their publics have been demanding since day one, which is an end to the hostilities?
In a word, I would call it cowardice. I think you can say that there's a lack of political will. I also think you can say that there is political cowardice at this moment. Very, very few nations have really stood up to support the Palestinians. Like we just heard from Carol, from one perspective, you've got nations still supplying Israel with weapons during a time in which 100 children a day are being murdered from the skies with those weapons. On the other side, you have, for example, Yemen, who is the poorest nation in Arabia, across the Middle East, West Asia, and has been bombarded for 10 years or so, gone through its own famine, and yet it wants to be able to do whatever it can. There was a famous statement that came out from the deputy foreign minister of Yemen this week when the United States of America started attacking it with its weapons. And it said, we're pleased, we're genuinely pleased that we are now being bombed, because all of this last 100 days, we've been calling to stop the bombardment, but we couldn't tell you what we felt like with this bombardment, and now we're receiving it. So at least we have some equity between ourselves and our Palestinian brethren. So you can see that the spectrum that there is available in the international scene, there's war criminals, there's maniacal nations, and there's others that are willing to be bombarded themselves just to be able to draw the eye of the specter on them and away from Gaza just for a little period of time, if possible. In between that sits the rest of the world, those that are nations that are doing very, very little. So I really feel that there's political cowardice on the face of the majority of the world when you're seeing what we're seeing unfolding.
We just heard Carol mention Germany there, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, what really motivates Germany to do this, you know, instead of calling for a ceasefire, for an end to the bloodshed, to the carnage, they're proceeding with providing the Israeli regime with more weaponry, feeding weapons into the Israeli war machine against the Palestinian people. Some people have called it Holocaust guilt. What do you make of that?
Germany is famous not just only for the Holocaust between 1935 and 1939 and 1945, but also the first Holocaust of the 20th century when it massacred thousands in Namibia. It seems that either we can say that there is sort of this guilt, or worse, we can actually say that there's something fundamentally wrong with a nation that consistently, over the span of 120 years, has been party to three genocides. And I feel that we should maybe stop giving Germany this sort of free pass by calling it this sort of guilt. If you truly had guilt, then you wouldn't be committing the same crimes over and over again, especially now in real time, when there are things like a case at the ICJ putting forth a ton of evidence of the genocide that then you are going to be party to. I'm not sure we can call it guilt. Mm-hmm. I actually think that there's something fundamentally wrong with their political makeup and the way in which they are idealizing this particular event.
You make a great point, Sheikh. We're going to stay with the World Economic Forum a bit longer. One of the speakers at the event was Jordanian Prime Minister Bashar al-Hassani, who addressed the South African government's case against the Israeli regime at the International Court of Justice, saying his country would participate if called upon. Let's listen in.
We cannot today, after the lapse of 101 days from this military operation and aggression that Israel has embarked upon in Gaza, we cannot today at all subscribe, as we have from day one, that this is an aggression operation that operates in the context of self-defense, as we all understand it. Self-defense in customary international law is a response to an action that is instant, overwhelming, that needs no choice or means or a moment for deliberation, and that has to be always conditioned by the two requisites of proportionality and necessity. And clearly, in the context of this, of those principles of customary international law that are entrenched in the Caroline case, all of this criteria is not something that's met by the Israeli reaction that has crossed all those boundaries and that have regrettably probably delved into elements of definitions contained in the Geneva Conventions about war crimes, about crimes against humanity, and even arguably in many instances and cases, if intent is shown, in the context of actions that could lead to an act of genocide.
I'll put my next question to Carol. And Carol, you heard what the Jordanian official had to say, the prime minister there. Jordan being the country that has seen the impact of displaced Palestinians. There's a sizable population of Palestinian refugees there. How important is it for regional countries to help push the case at the ICJ against Israel in solidarity with the Palestinians?
Well, why haven't they done it? Why is it 105 days? Why wait so long? Mm-hmm. You know, we've got all... And I was fortunate, I lived in Jordan and I seen... They're under stress. They're under stress. Not only did they take Palestinians, then they took the Syrians, and now they're taking the Palestinians again. And the people of Jordan are getting angry because there's not enough in the pot for everyone. Mm-hmm. And the other countries need to do their bit, you know. And it's all well and good saying, oh, let's put them here, let's put them there. These are people. This is their home. Palestine is their home. They don't want to leave their home. Yeah. And the ICJ, they need to be told it has to stop. We have to rebuild Gaza. We have to take the siege off of Gaza. We have to rebuild Palestine and give Palestinians the right to their homeland. All these little sand bites, this, that, and the other, it's not going to work. People need their homes.
No voluntary evacuation, which is a euphemism Israelis have been using for ethnic cleansing, basically.
Well, let's send them to Africa. Is that the latest one? Why would they want to leave their homes? You know, why have they done? Why have they persevered since 1948? If they had that choice then, they could have went off and made a new life somewhere. Mm-hmm. This is their home. They're not going nowhere. It's where they live. And no matter what the BBC and all these other stations say, like, oh, Israel's got the right to self-defense, Israel's got this, Israel's got that, Israel's not Israel. Israel is Palestine, and people need to recognize that thing, that it's Palestine, and the Palestinians need to be equal. They need to have equal rights, and all this has to stop. And unless the whole community, every community, not only Jordan, not only the help from the poor people of the Yemen, and not only the Lebanese resistance, everybody has to come in. They need to step up. Mm-hmm. And when we've got governments like our own government in Germany who are talking for the people, where the people, you've seen the millions of people on the streets week after week, day after day, they're not listening to us. They can't keep doing this and allowing these poor Palestinians to suffer in the way they are. Mm.
Sheikh Ladak, is the Israeli regime simply thumbing their nose at international institutions at this point? We've all heard what the Israeli prime minister had to say about the genocide case against Tel Aviv, that it's not going to stop them from continuing with this unfolding genocide.
Let me reverse the question, if I may. When has the Israeli regime not thumbed its nose at international institutions or at humanitarian institutions and organizations? If you just go back a second to that question about Jordan and then think about the second question that you've asked, Jordan's military and peacekeeping forces are actually quite significant. Potentially, Jordan can do a lot on the border with Palestine. Its military is some 8.7% of its total GDP. That's not small. It has some 60,000 peacekeeping officers that have been experienced enough to go to places like Angola, Afghanistan, Iraq. So they don't not have experience of how to be able to intervene and give safety to people when needed. So again, we need to ask these fundamental questions like we asked previously. Why are these nations not doing enough? Why are some willing to step up and some unwilling to do anything other than talk at best?
Why do you think that is, Sheikh?
We said earlier it's political cowardice. I do feel that the normalization with Israel has become so rampant amongst many of the Arab and Middle East states that so many of them have been put on the back foot that they don't know how to be able to get out of the pit that they've dug for themselves. So because of this has been an ongoing situation for decades now, that it's now so difficult to stop the Israeli regime, which is why you asked that follow-up question. Are they thumbing their nose? Well, when have they not done that? And when have they received any pushback from any significant Middle Eastern nation? So if you've had the experience of being a bully for decades, why would you stop now? What would a case at the ICJ do? What would a meeting at Davos really do? With respect, Israel only understands the language of force, and they've only seen that economic sanctions have done anything to them. At the moment, their international appeal or their PR campaign is so trodden on. They have been exposed by every camera in the world, and still they continue to commit genocide. Last night, just around Nasser Hospital, around Khan Yunus, carpet bombing around another hospital, cutting off telecommunications. They don't listen to logic. They don't listen to anything. Only force and only an international community is going to be able to stop them. And cowardice and being on the back foot is not going to support the Palestinian cause.
The language of force, the language that any occupier seems to understand. This is Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourza, where we zero in on news of and around the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. A genocide in 2024 with the entire world watching it live without any serious efforts to stop it defies logic. Two nations who have intervened include Yemen and South Africa. Earlier, we spoke to London-based barrister, activist, and writer Aisha Khan and asked her if Yemen was breaking any law by targeting vessels in the Red Sea.
Legally, the Americans have absolutely no right to be bombing Yemen. In legal terms, under the UN conventions and resolutions and decisions, and even the Genocide Convention itself, the Rome Treaties, what the legal position actually is that Yemen, as a state, has the duty to, if it sees genocide, to prevent it as it sees fit. So actually, the funny thing, or what we have not seen in the media, is going by the UN's own documents and own judgments and resolutions, Yemen is the only one, by preventing these ships from giving supplies to Israel, the only state acting in accordance with international law. The Yemenis have not killed anyone, have not killed any of their citizens. And we can actually see this in the rhetoric of Joseph Biden and Rishi Sunak. And they're very clear when they speak about why they are taking military action and why it is, and they've said it, is for commercial interests, to keep open commercial shipping lanes and to ensure that commercial ships are not blocked. So they are very clearly saying they are protecting the interests and the private property of the rich and believe that this is a reason to bomb. Obviously, this is not a reason to bomb. It's nothing to do with state security or national security. And at this point, they're just acting as militias for billionaires and for private interests, which is not in their remit at all. And they're acting absolutely illegally.
Aisha urged people from all over the world to write to judges at the ICJ in the South African case against Israel to remind them of the importance of ruling in favor of Palestinian lives and against Tel Aviv's onslaught.
As we are not parties to these proceedings, there is no reason we cannot email the judges to remind them about the evidence, and the evidence, obviously, of children being having their limbs amputated, disabled children, the mass amount of death in Gaza. And this is simply to remind the judges that they are not state actors, they are jurists, and that their primary concern is the law and is basing their judgments on evidence. This is no different to what Israel actually has done, where they took a diplomatic mission to all of these countries in order for their states to put pressure on these judges to make decisions in the state political interests and not on a legal basis. And we will see this in particular with the American judge, who I absolutely doubt will vote for South Africa's case and will be very heavily swayed by Israel based on the fact that she is under pressure, diplomatic and political pressure, from her own government and from Israel. So if Israel can try and pervert the course of justice, there is no reason why normal human beings, me and you, cannot send evidence to these judges to remind them that they are judges and they are not state actors.
The human cost of the statistics detailing the killed and injured can sometimes be lost in the mire of analysis. An Israeli strike on a house in Rafah has taken the lives of three members of a family sheltering inside. The lament of the distraught father is a tragic reminder that the bombardment of Gaza has left no family unscathed.
When the strike first hit, I woke up screaming, "Massa, Massa," not knowing what had happened. I was unaware of what was going on. I looked around and found that the bombing happened inside my home. Where are my siblings? Where are my children? Thank God, anyway. My daughter has been killed, and my injured brother is in the European hospital, while my second injured daughter is in the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar hospital.
Sheikh Ladak, let's dig deeper a little bit, if we can, on the action taken by South Africa and Yemen in solidarity with Palestinians. What do you make of what they have done? And as far as the South African genocide case against Israel is concerned, what are your hopes and fears in terms of which way the ruling will go?
Between these two great nations, we can see that many of the bases that need covering in this ongoing fight against Israel is being covered. So from one perspective, you have a legal case, you have a diplomatic side. And then from the perspective of Yemen, we have a military campaign and an economic campaign to be able to stop this genocide that's taking place. If you take a step back and try to see what the world is doing, the world is in many cases putting pressure points on all the different areas that it needs to. It's trying to put pressure at the governmental level. A media campaign, especially through social media, to try to raise awareness. People are taking to the streets. So there is so much being done to try to pressurize this entity to try to stop what it's doing. What my fears are that many people will put stock in the ICJ case to such an extent that if they decide not to find Israel guilty of its genocide, then people may lose hope of this sort of diplomatic and legal solution. The reality is that no matter what comes from the ICJ, there is no legal reprimand on Israel. Rather, this is the United Nations top court and not actually a court that can actually do anything in terms of a legal reprimand. Yeah. So what I don't want people to do is to lose hope just in case this side of the angle actually doesn't help. What we can see is that by virtue of Britain and America bombing Yemen, it actually shows that this has caused them to intervene to such an extent where they need to directly now intervene in their support for Israel. Can you imagine how much damage Yemen must be doing to the Israeli economy, to the global forces of evil that are carrying out their maniacal practices and behaviors? Otherwise, you wouldn't see them intervening. Now, you can go further with your analysis. The fact that the global media, the Western media, has to hide the truth about what Yemen is doing and not speak about it in its plain context is another evidence of how important Yemen's role is in this conflict. Let me give you an example. If you turn anywhere on BBC News, you will only see that they will say that this is in support of Palestine. They won't say that they gave a condition. You are starving the people of Palestine. There's no medicines going through. You have to be able to open up the borders to allow these things through. Then we will stop our advances on the Strait of Manda. All of this shows how the Yemeni cause has become.
Okay. Carol Swartz, Sheikh Ladak, thank you both for your contributions. And thank you for spending time with us. We'll be back with the latest news and analysis. Until we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Experts are saying a major factor in drug shortages in the United States is the government's failure to regulate profit-hungry drug companies. The U.S. federal government does not monitor raw materials in medications or oversee manufacturing processes that take place abroad. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The latest data shows shortages of life-saving medications have reached record highs in the United States. According to the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, in 2023, the number of drug shortages was estimated to be 309. This is a rise of 30% since 2021 and a record high. Patients with aggressive blood cancers, deadly pneumonia, and mental illness are just some of those waiting more than a year for vital medicines. The average wait for a medication on the drug shortage list is 15 months. More than 15 of those drugs have been in short supply for more than a decade, compared to the average shortage duration of 1.5 years, and statistics show doctors are struggling. 83% of oncologists reported to the New England Journal of Medicine they have been unable to prescribe their preferred chemotherapy medication due to drug shortages. A recent American Cancer Society survey found 1 in 10 patients have been affected by drug shortages, forcing them to use substitute drugs or delay medical treatment. Most of these drugs are generic medicines, meaning they cost the patient and insurer far less than branded versions. Nearly all, or 96%, of shortages are caused by issues within human control, such as manufacturing and supply and demand protocols. The Bray family had always prided themselves on a positive outlook in life, and in 2018, when they received the devastating news that their 9-year-old daughter, Abby, had life-threatening leukemia, they tried to focus on finding a way out of the situation. She had great doctors and a precise, effective treatment regimen. Her outlook was positive. Until, that is, the hospital ran out of drugs that were keeping her alive. Abby's mother, Laura, from Florida, was shocked when one afternoon during Abby's treatment, the oncologist suggested she take her daughter home and wait for the medication to become available again. Laura, a cancer campaigner, told the Daily Mail, "But I was afraid that if she missed one session, the cancer could come back. And she's not the only one," families have told the Daily Mail, of the devastating toll of drug shortages blighting Americans across the country, resulting in a tide of preventable deaths. Brooke and Ryan Dwarves from Iowa are two more victims of the crisis, having missed out on vital chemotherapy medicine. In April of 2021, Brooke Dwarves, who was 36 at the time, was undergoing chemotherapy to treat pancreatic cancer. After 6 rounds of surgery, the special education teacher was declared disease-free in September of that year, but less than a year later, the cancer was back. It had spread to his liver. A different regimen of chemotherapy began in December with a drug called cisplatin, which the Dwarves did not know was on the drug shortage list. But in May of 2023, while still in treatment, doctors told him the drug was in short supply, so they were giving priority to curable patients and children. The hospital was down to its last vial of cisplatin, the multiple facilities across the country also struggling to get hold of the drug. Brooke Dawes told Daily Mail, "Everybody is disappointed, and I can imagine the poor doctors having to tell patients we don't have your treatment that you need, and that's working." Brooke Dawes added, "But it was kind of disgusting. You hear that and say, well, what about my 37-year-old husband with two young kids? It seems like it doesn't matter because he can't be cured." Desperate for a solution, the couple took a punt on social media, posting about their situation and asking if anyone could help supply the medicine. A friend spotted the plea and put them in touch with a charity that helps cancer patients access drugs that are limited in supply, founded by Abby Bray's mother, Laura. The organization called Angels for Change helped Ryan Dawes apply through the Food and Drug Administration for an emergency supply via a specialist government scheme. Not only was Ryan Dawes able to complete his last four rounds of chemotherapy, a few other patients at the hospital used the same method to access the drug too. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. The drug shortage crisis, which is impacting America more than any other Western nation, does seem to be getting lawmakers' attention. In November, the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance held a session dedicated to the issue. Experts say a major factor in drug shortages is the U.S. government's failure to regulate profit-hungry pharmaceutical companies. The federal government does not monitor raw materials in medications or overseas manufacturing processes that take place abroad. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, states drug shortages could stem from companies discontinuing older generic drugs that are no longer profitable in favor of branded ones that will make more money. The administration states discontinuations are another factor contributing to drug shortages. It added, "The Food and Drug Administration can't require a firm to keep making a drug it wants to discontinue. Sometimes these older drugs are discontinued by companies in favor of newer, more profitable drugs." A Senate report published in March stated that while many critical generic drugs require highly complex manufacturing processes, they ultimately cost pennies on the dollar. Another factor driving the problem is America's reliance on materials from China and India to make nearly all medicines used in emergency care. Foreign manufacturers registered with the FDA more than doubled between 2010 and 2015. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, already has limited oversight into drug manufacturing, but handing over those responsibilities to foreign entities further complicates the process because the United States has no insight into overseas manufacturing, quality or supply chain issues. Drug shortages were thrust into the spotlight during the COVID-19 pandemic as Americans faced empty shelves of popular pain relievers and cold remedies, forcing them to go store to store in search of medications that they needed. Critical drug shortages in the United States include albuterol, an asthma and allergy medication used to prevent and treat breathing difficulty, amoxicillin, a crucial antibiotic used to treat bacterial infections, epinephrine or adrenaline, a drug used to treat life-threatening conditions like severe allergic reactions. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, there were 54 million prescriptions written for amoxicillin in 2019. In 2020, nearly 62 million albuterol prescriptions were handed out, and in 2020, 1.7 million prescriptions were written for epinephrine.
Hello. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the 17th of January 1961, Patrice Lumumba, the great fighter for Congo's independence, was tortured and then executed. Western intelligence agencies, particularly America's CIA and Britain's MI6, conspired with Belgium, the former colonizer of the country, and local traitors to overthrow and assassinate Lumumba. Now, this anti-colonial hero was only 35 years old and could have continued to play a very important role in the post-independence progress of his country and Africa. As the leader of the Congolese national movement, Lumumba was chosen by the people to lead an independent Congo emerging from brutal colonial rule under Belgium. An estimated 10 million people were killed during the barbaric colonial rule by this European power over Congo. Lumumba was determined to use the country's natural resources, which had been subject to decades of colonial and imperialist exploitation, for the benefit of the Congolese people. This is what angered Western powers, and they decided to eliminate him. The people of the Democratic Republic of Congo still languish in poverty, despite the country's enormous natural resources. Now, 63 years after the assassination of Lumumba, can this country rise and fulfill his dreams of prosperity for the nation and Africa as a whole? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on the legacy of Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese independence hero who was assassinated 63 years ago in an elaborate plot led by the notorious U.S. spy agency, the CIA, and Britain's MI6.
Remembering Patrice Lumumba. Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba was assassinated six decades ago, but his name remains synonymous with Africa's struggle against imperialism. His speech during the proclamation of Congo's independence in June 1960 angered Western powers, and this led to his eventual assassination.
To discuss the legacy of Patrice Lumumba, we have contacted Kambalaye Musavuli, a political analyst and a human rights activist. He's also the spokesperson for the Friends of the Congo. Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Gideon Balaike, the Secretary General of African Coalition for Development. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be part of this conversation.
Now, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and Britain's MI6 were the main conspirators with Belgium in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. So let's start off with Mr. Masavuli. Why did these Western imperialist colonial powers decide to sponsor this heinous crime?
One of the reasons, one of the reasons Patrice Lumumba was assassinated is because he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. He fought for the independence of the Congo, and it was clear that when Congo got its independence, that the resources of the land will benefit the Congolese, building infrastructure and providing opportunities to Congolese. That did not sit well with Dwight Eisenhower, the president of the United States at the time. This is at the height of the Cold War. Congo has cobalt. The United States needs cobalt for its military industry. And as many will remember, Dwight Eisenhower did have a speech on January 17, 1961, talking about the military industrial complex. But what people will not know, even though he made the speech on January 17, 1961, that day he made that speech, his CIA operatives in the DRC killed, were participating in the killing of the first democratically elected leader of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba.
Lumumba's assassination came less than 7 months after independence. No doubt, this assassination impacted negatively on the ideals of national economic unity, economic independence, and Pan-African solidarity that Lumumba had championed. Laurent Lumumba, the son of Lumumba, says his dad sacrificed his life for Congo and Africa.
The Congolese youth should maintain the struggle and fight for our values like my late dad. He chose to sacrifice for the country and Africa as a whole. He once said, if the Congo requires a martyr, then I will be the first one.
Now let's bring in Gideon Balaike. Can we say that this CIA crime shattered the hopes of millions of Congolese for freedom and material prosperity?
Yes, absolutely. The shadow of Lumumba still continue to be alive today, even in the Congolese politics. There is a huge inheritance of that assassination that can be seen today in the Congolese politics. As you know, Lumumba was a revolutionary leader, a nationalistic leader, but he was not, a communist, as if most of the Western stakeholders wanted to tag him. Lumumba was just a revolutionary person who wanted something greater for the Congo. He was a visionary person because he saw the Congo of the future, and that was seen as a danger for people who had interest in the Congo, and that's why they ended up assassinating him, because they didn't want to have someone who has a critical thinking, someone who think about his people, someone who is a real patriot. They wanted people that could be easily manipulated. And that's why the CIA, in collaboration with Belgium, they assassinated Patrice Lumumba. But unfortunately, the United States government that controls the CIA has never been held accountable up to date. We need a reparation because they have a legacy in what is happening currently in the Congo.
Lumumba's old friend and Army Chief of General Staff, Mobutu, staged his first coup and dismissed both the President and the Prime Minister on September 14, 1960. The lesson here is that the destruction and plundering of African after independence cannot be possible without the collaboration of locals. Such collaboration continues to impact negatively on Africa.
Congolese people are clear about the imperialists. Congolese people are clear about people who want to subject them to inhumane conditions. They've always resisted any oppression. Unfortunately, the forces, the external forces, have been able to affect the situation in the Congo. Specifically for what you said about Mobutu, Joseph Mobutu, who was an aide to Patrice Lumumba during the independence movement, and then became the head of the Congolese army. Through the CIA, they were able to coach Mobutu to be able to take the reign of government in DRC, his first coup, where he dismissed both the president and the prime minister to have the military take control, was actually guided by the CIA. So, yes, there are locals who are cooperating. They are a very small minority. They are back, they are financed, and they are provided the necessary support to be able to hold millions of people hostages. And this model still, unfortunately, exists still today, where Africans are still fighting to rid themselves of neocolonial agents of the West. And they will be successful as we continue in this struggle to defeat them so that the people can have a say in the decision-making process.
In June 2022, the Belgian government returned the remains of Patrice Lumumba to his family and purported to apologize for his murder. His son commented on this move.
Je ne peux pas dire, c'est la joie.
I can't say it's joyous, but it's positive for us. It's positive that we can finally bury one of ours.
Now, Mr. Baleke, was the return of Patrice Lumumba's remains and the so-called apology issued by Belgium enough to atone for these horrendous crimes?
They returned the thief of Patrice Lumumba. That was symbolic. You remember, he was burned out in acidic water and killed, assassinated. So the only remaining part was his teeth. And his family has been reclaiming that for years so that they could, bury symbolically a part of the body for their father, Patrice Lumumba. So for the family perspective, that was, that was something great. And we had to demand for that. And we need as well reparation overall politically, because the role Belgium played in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba continues to have repercussions up to date in the Congolese political sphere. And, they misled the Congo, like they took the Congo out of a trajectory of progress and put it in a trajectory of
corruption and manipulation and neocolonialism.
Belgium's King Philippe visited the Democratic Republic of Congo early June 2022, and as expected, he flatly refused to apologize for his country's brutal and inhumane crimes in the Congo. King Philippe only offered what he termed as his deepest regrets for his nation's colonial-era genocide and extermination of millions of Congolese people, including women and children.
King Philippe stopped short of apologizing for colonial-era atrocities angering the people of Congo and Africans across the world. Now, what's your take on this statement by the king?
Of course, it's okay to say apology, but Congo needs more than an apology. Congo needs reparation. So from King Leopold losing 10 to 15 million people to the colonial rule where Congolese had to fight World War I and World War II on behalf of Belgium, and they did not even get paid for that operations, right? That's still a contention. From the copper extracted from our land, from the uranium taken in the Congo, under Belgian hands, taken in the Congo, given to the Americans for the so-called Manhattan Project, and this uranium went to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. All that oppression, and to even colonize that and say that Congolese cannot be independent, Congo needs more than an apology. Congo needs reparation. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? It means that any corporations from back then to now, we know the names, they still exist, must provide reparation to the Congolese. The Union Minière du Haut-Katanga, which still exists today under a different name in Belgium, made billions of dollars back then and continue to make billions today. And the states, right? That's the call. Reparations need to be financial, materials, and also anything they've ever taken from the Congo must return to the DRC. Congo does not need only an apology. Congo needs reparation.
Thank you for that, Mr. Mosavoli. Let's take a short break before we continue with our show on Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese independence hero who was brutally assassinated by Western colonial powers.
Remembering Patrice Lumumba.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. Our discussion is on the CIA-led assassination of Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba. Now, during the Cold War era, the United States, which claims to advocate for democracy, supported the most brutal African dictators. For instance, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA installed Mobutu Sese Seko as the president who ruled Congo with an iron fist and even changed the name of the country to Zaire. Here is one of Mobutu's visits to Washington, where he met the then U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
And I am pleased to have been able to meet again with President Mobutu, who's been a faithful friend of the United States for some 20 years. The President and I took this opportunity to review the state of U.S.-Zairean relations, and we found a large area of agreement on the major points.
Now, Mr. Baleke, what's your opinion on U.S. double standards on democracy, where it assassinates a democratically elected president or leader like Lumumba and props up a dictator like Mobutu?
That's, you know, that's one of the greatest examples in the 20th century of the American foreign policy cynicism and, you know, and neocolonialism, imperialism. We had a different context during those days with the Cold War. So it was an hegemonic war that was being played with African leaders.
The progressive forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo are struggling to ensure that the masses control and determine the affairs of the Congo. Patrice Lumumba gave his life so that the sons and daughters of the Congo would ultimately take ownership of the country's wealth for their benefit and for the benefit of Africa overall. A Congolese citizen here speaks on the anti-colonial legacy of Patrice Lumumba and how current leaders have betrayed this legacy.
Yeah, the left us a great legacy. That is working for the people and avoiding influence from Western countries. But we see since the Second Republic, our country is still being dominated by foreign powers.
Now, despite efforts by progressive forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo to eliminate neocolonial influence over the past few years, we have seen a marked increase of American special forces in eastern DRC. Now, Mr. Musavuli, what are these U.S. troops doing in these mineral-rich regions that continue to see deadly rebels roaming across with impunity?
In the context of the conflict in the Congo today, and with the Congolese government, Congolese military trying to have regained sovereignty over the land, they've had foreign militaries training, not just the United States, but different ones. But specifically for your question in terms of the United States, they've been engaged in military training, particularly in the northeast part of the Congo, where they've done training for Med Flag, beyond even the United States. Right now, Israel has been training the Congolese forces that we call the Republican Guard, right? Whereby in October 2003, it was reported that over 200 IDF forces who were training the Congolese army had to leave the DRC to go kill Palestinians, pretty much. They left the Congo to go fight in Gaza. They are training soldiers who are also committing human rights abuse. The United Nations report that was just released this December documented how the Republican Guard, trained by the IDF, killed civilians in numbers up to over 100, took their bodies and went to hide their bodies. This is documented in a UN report, and no consequences for the soldiers who committed these crimes. There have been a few who've been arrested, but no fundamental consequence in the chain of command order for the killing of the civilians, and no accountability for the Israeli soldiers who train these troops. So the military training, unfortunately, is only reinforcing oppressive regimes in the Congo who, when these soldiers are trained, they are going to also harm the Congolese population, who are demanding the end of the conflict. They want peace, they want stability, and after two decades of war, we do not need more military presence, military training. What we need is accountability for crimes taking place and holding U.S. allies and Israeli allies on the African continent accountable.
According to diplomatic messages between Brussels and its former colony, Lumumba, the newborn republic's first prime minister, was a man to be eliminated. So there is no shadow of doubt that these assassins are well known.
The people of Congo believe that justice will one day be served, and those who assassinated Patrice Lumumba will pay for their heinous crime.
The biggest form of justice we could give to Patrice Lumumba as Congolese revolutionary is, to perpetuate his legacy. And they killed Lumumba, but they didn't kill the idea of Lumumba. He was killed, but his idea has never been killed. And that's the greatest thing, you know. You could see Lumumba, he's a patriotic figure, not
only in the Congo, but all across Africa. So he's still a symbol up to date of resistance against neocolonialism. And that's the greatest legacy. But I think the greatest achievement and the greatest gift we could give to Patrice Lumumba is to liberate the Congo from all the ashes of imperialism, to liberate the Congo from all corruption and incompetent leaders that are manipulated from Western or Eastern angles, is to liberate the Congo from all the bad things that are happening in the country and to make it a free, a really independent country, prosperous country that definitely work for the interests of all Congolese people who deserve to live into dignity. That's the best way to honor the memory of Patrice Lumumba.
Last month, the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo voted in a general election where the incumbent won. Felix Tshisekedi was re-elected as DRC's president for a second term, but the opposition contested these results due to numerous violations in the electoral process. This country has great potential and vast mineral and natural resources valued as an estimated $24 trillion.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been facing political instability and armed violence since 1996, with an estimated 6 million people killed since the conflict began. Western tech giants continue to profit from Congo's conflict minerals while locals suffer. A Congolese civilian affected by conflict in the mineral-rich DRC speaks here on his suffering.
We have suffered a lot. Hunger, disease, death, women are raped, and the list goes on. We don't want this life of begging. At home, we had fields, cattle, and we lived very well. The most important thing is to stop the war so that we can return home.
Now, the dream of Patrice Lumumba was that Congo's immense natural resources should bring prosperity and peace for the Congolese. This dream is yet to be achieved. Mr. Musavule, you have the last word today. Now, is the current government of the DRC moving towards Lumumba's dream?
You clearly stated it. Now, Congo is the largest African country, the second largest African country by size after Algeria. And by population, is the fourth largest African country by population, right? And has so much wealth, mm-hmm. right, from its fauna and flora. From its resources on the ground, the minerals, the gold, the coltan, the tin, the cobalt, this mineral used in all these Tesla vehicles. Now, Congo is the number one producer of cobalt in the world, so you can't drive an electric vehicle without Congo's cobalt in it. It's virtually impossible. But this wealth is only benefiting the elites. The Congolese people are still in the pursuit of the ideals of Patrice Lumumba. Mm-hmm. This is why, since 2006, as you watch all the presidential elections, you still see Congolese protesting, organizing, saying that they want leaders who represent the will. So the Congolese people have not given up on the ideals of Lumumba. They are fighting. But what is important in their context of fighting to liberate mm-hmm. the country?
Well, as our guest said, the people of Congo are still struggling to ensure that the aspirations of Patrice Lumumba are attained. I'd like to thank our guests, Kambale, Musavule and Gideon Baleke for their incisive analysis today.
My name is George Zongola Ntelaja, Professor of African Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I was asked by the Ohio University Press to write the book on Patrice Lumumba in a series of books on great African leaders. Patrice Lumumba